Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Writers Panel. I'm Ben Blacker, the creator and moderator of the podcast. I created the show because I wanted to talk to writers about the business and process of writing. I've had more than 400 writers on the show, so go back and check the archives. I'm sure you'll find more creators and more shows that you're interested in. I'm a writer myself, having written with my partner Ben Acker for Supernatural, Puss in Boots, FX's Cassius and Clay, among others. We've also written comics for Marvel, Image, Dynamite, and more. We created a show called The Thrilling Adventure Hour. Maybe you'd like it. Go to thrillingadventurehour.com for more info. Let me know who you want to hear on this podcast by following me on Twitter, at Ben Blacker, like the color, only more so, and follow me on Tumblr at writerspanel.tumblr.com. And if you enjoy the show, please leave a review on iTunes. It always makes me feel good about myself.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writers Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
Great.
David Mandel is here.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
David, you took over showrunning.
Yes.
A Veep this year.
Yeah.
And it was great.
Oh, well, thank you.
That's enjoyed this season.
Let's just end it right there.
Yeah. What's your secret? Let's talk about Veep.
Yeah.
The season just ended as of this recording. It'll be a week ago. They're all available on HBO Go, so people can check them out. Were you involved with the show before that, right?
No, actually. That's I think, what makes it, I hate to say, a unique situation without knowing the details.
Kind of is,
but having been on shows where people then leave the shows and you rise up and there's a natural process, this was definitely different. I mean, I was a fan of the show. I was watching. For me, it was, you know, on probably a small list of shows that, like, I was really watching, but also, you know, watching with my wife, which is always, that's always a good thing. And I certainly wasn't sitting there analyzing it, like I can't wait till Armando surprises everybody and leaves and they call me. I was watching the show.
You were a fan?
Yeah, I was a fan of the show, which was a nice thing. I was, you know, even I was surprised when they called. Not so much that they were calling, but just, you know, I had no idea he was even thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Probably in some more version of, like, you know, like comedy writing rooms are chatty. And I feel like had they been making the show here in L.A., word would have gotten out, like, oh, he's thinking of leaving, or just something like that, or whatever. But I think, guess because it was, you know, mostly all Brits, and they were kind of working in, like, Baltimore and London, it was just like, whoa, he's leaving, you know. So, but no, it was a real shock. And definitely, you know, I definitely had to think about it for about half a second, but it was just sort of like, okay, well, that's new. But, I took over a show I didn't work on. So
that's really interesting. Why do you think you were the guy?
I think I kind of know, which was I was working with, or I have worked over the last couple of years, anyone who kind of pretends to sort of chart what I do. I do stuff alone, but I've also worked a lot with two guys, Jeff Schaefer and Alec Burke. Mm-hmm. We are friends from college. We wrote on and off together on, like, Seinfeld. There are episodes that are by me and myself, but there are also episodes by, and there's episodes by them together, but there's episodes of the three of us together. We did a lot of movie stuff together over the years. The, you know, last thing, I guess, Eurotrip, Dictator, those are a couple. And so the three of us have been doing a lot of the stuff together, and we were doing Curb Your Enthusiasm together with Larry. So it was the three of us and Larry. And obviously Larry, well, now he's doing Curb again, but if we'd been doing this 2 days ago, no, Curb's been gone for a long time. I guess now it'll be 3 weeks, but whenever this thing airs. But anyway, so we did Curb Enthusiasm with Larry, and then somewhere in there, after when Curb kind of started to go away, Jeff started doing The League, which was a show he created with his wife, Jackie. And then somewhere in there, they had the Silicon Valley pilot, and Alec kind of got brought in and did sort of, you know, help them, I think, do some reshoots, and then became sort of the, I guess, co-showrunner with...
Yeah, something like that. Maybe number
yes,
two.
Yes, exactly. They are, whatever, equals and all that kind of good stuff. And so he's doing that. And so, I mean, I honestly believe, you know, in a world where there was no Curb Your Enthusiasm at the time, you know, over a year ago, I think it worked really well on the Silicon Valley thing and sort of the values that Larry has instilled in the three of us. And so when this opportunity sort of presented itself... I've been led to believe that Casey Bloys, who is now the head of HBO, but at the time was just the head of comedy. Mm-hmm. I think I was kind of a short list of one, and I think it was sort of that the Curb experience where he sort of felt like Veep is this sort of unique creature, and the closest thing kind of in it, the closest cousin is Curb, and let's get another Curb guy. So I do believe that was kind of the reason. Yeah,
it makes a lot of sense. So when you get that call, what was the timeline, and like what do you do next? You just start mainlining the show to figure out how it ticks?
You know, I mainlined a bit in the sense of, you know, as I said, I had been a big fan, and I think I started talking to them like in February, and then sat down with Julia and talked with her, and it kind of slowly developed. And so somewhere in there, they kind of hit me with the 10 scripts of the season and then started showing me either almost finished or finished cuts as they had them of the 10 unaired episodes.
Okay.
So I really mainlined that more so than had to go backwards, because I was a fan. Sure. And I kind of, you know, and I remembered it, and I also felt like, and I don't know if I ever sat down and wrote this down as a thing, but I actually thought there was a value in what, as someone who had watched the first three seasons as a fan and then now just watched season four kind of straight through as much as I could in a sitting, because I think they gave me like four and then another couple and whatever. And I knew this tie thing was coming. So I kind of did all of that. I was sort of, in retrospect, interested, I guess, in what I thought was important, having watched the show regular, as opposed to, I'm going to go back through and, you know, like, rewatch every one of them and write stuff down. So there were certain things that I think did jump out at me as I started to pop into season five, and I felt like these were sort of big things, whether they were hanging stories or bits of things or things I wanted to know more about, that I sort of just naturally brought forward with me as a fan. I think it kind of worked out well as we sort of attacked the season. So one of the big things, for example, was, again, however they meant it, I don't know what they meant,
right,
but like the whole Selena Tom James thing, which was sort of hinted at in an episode, and I later found out, well, they had shot more, but they cut it, and whatever. But to me, it was one of those wonderful things where this notion of this cab ride, where maybe would they have, could they have, should they have, was this little thing. And even though never mentioned again, I felt like both actors sort of used it and kind of colored their performance after that point came up. And I felt like that's something we have to get into, especially as we started sort of talking about what Tom James's role in the season was going to be. So again, another thing that jumped out at me was Mike, there's a great episode where he's, you know, got his sperm in the cooler and whatnot. And I thought, wow, that's a storyline, like whatever happened to, did they ever get kids? And that's something we picked up on. And it kind of came because that was just something as a fan, I guess, that stood out for me when I was watching originally. So I guess that was sort of my approach, even though I didn't really plan on it being my approach. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you pull out the stuff that you're interested in.
I guess that's the honest answer. Yeah.
Without, you know, I feel like there could be the threat of it becoming fanfic, right?
Right.
If you're this huge fan of it, you
want to
play with all the
toys. Exactly. And then there are things, you know, where, you know, I definitely had a lot of fun this season with the sort of the Dan and Amy relationship, which I sort of, I think, was taking advantage of the fanfic desire, what they want.
Right.
But, you know, you got to remember, I was taught sitcom writing by the man that killed Susan. You know what I mean? So it's sort of like, you know, it was fun to kind of go, oh, is this what you want? Well, I'm going to put them right at the edge of a doorway and then have it sort of cock blocked by Amy's sister. But again, sort of taking advantage of, like, what I liked as the show, but also thinking about what other people, really want to happen and making sure that can never happen.
You're ruthless.
Yes.
Can you talk about, we've talked to a couple of writers in the past. The show is written in sort of an unusual way. Did that,
you know, obviously I wasn't there.
Right.
I'm not quite sure that the show was as unusually written as, I don't know. It's a little bit like, you know, the legends of these shows. And it's true. And I say this only because, you know, I hear it about like Curb Your Enthusiasm all the time. Like, we've just got this like you know, two sentence outline or something. No, we have very long, often 14 page outline that quite honestly you could write a script from quite easily.
Right.
And on top of that, we have our notes from like when we're riffing on stuff of things that maybe we don't put in the outline, but we are sort of, once it gets rolling, kind of want to remember that this is a possibility so that we can then go up and go, why don't you quote unquote improv about these ideas? And I don't mean it in a bad way. Yeah. It is still improv in the sense that there aren't script pages, but I think people tend with Curb, for example, to make it this sort of like out of nothing improvisation,
right.
And it's not. And I think going back to sort of jumping over to Veep, they are definitely a show in a great way that sort of they like to play with stuff and workshop stuff and whatever. But, you know, again, I think it was always being done for the most part, I think, in the past with scripts, as far as I can tell. And I'm a big believer in that. My sort of feeling is you write a script, and if you take one, take two, first couple of takes, get the script. I'm just talking philosophically.
Yeah.
Get your script and then have as much fun as you want or can or take it wherever you can.
You have that foundation.
Yes, exactly. If you don't have the foundation, though, you have nothing.
Absolutely.
So I hope I'm not agitated about this in any way, shape, or form. I'm just trying to sort of saying that the legends of these various shows are never quite true. We have a script. We love to play with it. The actors have suggestions. They've been living with these characters. Mm-hmm. We get it on its feet. We try stuff. Someone says something funny. We're not idiots. We write it down and we add it to the script.
Sure.
But I'm not sure it's as unique a process. Like I'm saying it, like, I'm not sure it's magic. It's great. It's great.
Well,
and it's logical.
Yes.
But I'm not sure it's that different from what a lot of scripted sort of what we might think of as our funny scripted shows are doing.
It's far from an Aaron Sorkin show.
No,
but it's not
every word is not precious.
Yeah.
We play with stuff and some wonderful things come out of our rehearsals that take things further, that change things. You know, again, the way they play with stuff. And, you know, there are definitely places where, you know, I'll write into a script, you know, like, you know, for example, like, you know, Tony Hale reacts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not charting his exact, you know, it's not like I'm not making, putting sound effects in. And we'll, you know, and he'll do something and we'll play with that, whatever. So it's a creation, but, you know, and there's lots of fun and play and all sorts of stuff. Like I said, it's always that funny thing about the tales, I guess.
Oh, of course. These things take on legend.
Hopefully any good comedy show with good comedy people, it has a script and then it, you know, takes advantage of having,
absolutely.
And we have some of the best improvers, but I'm a big believer in improving off of a place.
Mm-hmm.
And because freeform improv, it can be, I guess, on the flip side, one of the worst things in the world. So
sure.
I guess that's my larger point. But we have definitely maintained, I guess, to loop it back around, we have maintained trying to rehearse key and important scenes and, you know, and really sort of that, I hope we have maintained a sense that anybody can throw in a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll take a joke from Craft Services if they've got a good idea.
Yeah.
So I think we've definitely maintained that. Because I think the thing that is great about Veep, that is maybe, I don't want to say unique, but is special about Veep, is that at the end of the day, obviously the work is important, whatever, but, you know, somewhat comedy does rule, you know, and that sounds unique to me only because, I don't know, sometimes when you watch network television on the comedies, that may not be the rule.
Sure.
So I think that's ultimately what's important, is just we're trying to make the funniest show.
That's great.
And we'll take it wherever we can get it.
It's nice to hear. Not just we're trying to stay alive,
we're
just trying to do a thing. tell me a little bit, if you would, about how you ran the room. The room is here for your season.
Yes, the room was here. We got a tax. The show lost the tax
That's
credit
right.
in Baltimore, which I guess went away completely, and then got one of the first of the new California tax credits, which was great. And it was doubly good. This has nothing to do with your question. It was doubly good for me because besides me and the writers, while I'm sure it was a great crew and everything in Baltimore, by moving it here, it ended up that there were more than just like me and the writers being new. There were changes across the board. There was, you know, a lot of new crew and stuff. We ended up with a new, you know, producer. We ended up, you know, with a new DP. So
Interesting.
I think it helped me to basically not be the only new person.
Yeah,
so that was actually kind of a good thing. In terms of the room, I guess I'll say a couple of things. We basically spent a lot of last summer, you know, kind of sitting around the room talking about ideas and talking about things that could happen. Let me back it up. I like to know where we're going. So when I first started meeting with Julia and was sort of told about the tie, we just, you know, we would sort of chatted about the story. And I kind of came up ultimately with what I thought the end of the show was. Mm-hmm. And that's how I like to work. So I kind of knew this season where we were going. And then there were some things along the way that I knew I wanted to do. So when we sort of spent a lot of the summer talking about these ideas and, you know, obviously fleshing them out and adding to things, whatever, and kind of starting to throw things into columns of sort of like things. And out of that kind of a sort of a 10 show kind of a thing. That being said, once we got to a certain point, I do not like the room. So let me be incredibly clear, because it's sort of, I think taken for granted. I think a room can be really good to talk about concepts conceptually. I think a room can be really good for punching up something. Maybe not too big a room, but a room can be good for punching up something, where you have something and you're just looking to beat jokes, make jokes better, and whatnot. What I do not think a room is good for, what I actually fucking hate rooms for, is shows where shows are written in rooms. It is just, I mean, I'm sure there are some exceptions, that there are some great shows that are written in rooms, but I will simply say that there are thousands of shows with rooms, and only a couple that I think have had great shows being written in rooms, whereas a large majority of shows that don't have rooms are great. And I will simply say there is no room at Curb. There was no room at Seinfeld. And we don't have a traditional room at Veep for the same reason, which is I want, and again, this was, again, some of what, like, sort of, I think Larry imparted on me back in the Seinfeld days, which is writer responsibility for their own sort of episode. I love the idea of writer responsibility for their own stories. In this case, we were, perhaps the stories were a little more of some of my stories and things that I was bringing in earlier on, because there was, as we kind of started to think about the season, it was kind of 10 weeks until this special election. Not that each episode was a week, but it was a very tightly wound, a little perhaps more intricately woven season as we were trying to solve this tie, because I felt like it called for that. But that being said, I tried to let the writer of each episode go off and write his script. Yes, we're working on the outlines. I'm looking at outlines. I'm giving suggestions and changing. But I am a big believer in writer responsibility. And what I find happens in a room is like three things. Number one, in these giant rooms, I can pitch out a lot of a great story, but it's your turn to write. So now you're going off and you're writing something that ostensibly is mine. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not good. And then I think the room has a tendency, and this can even happen, by the way, in Punch Up as well, which is there are things that only seem funny in a room at 2 a.m. when everybody's very tired and whatnot. And it is this thing, you know, they're not real jokes. I don't know that you call them room jokes. I always call it like joke-like substances, but I hate it. And I understand why. You want to go home. And that's a lot of it. I think a lot of being trapped in that room is wanting to go home. And I just hate it. So I am not a room guy. And I think we used the room well, and a lot of good things came out of our room in terms of bigger story suggestions. But when it came to at least trying, for the most part, and don't get me wrong, there were things where you go, that's not working, let's all talk about it and whatever. But I don't want to compose in a room. I don't want to write from scratch in a room. I don't want us all writing together in a room. I'd much rather go sit down at a computer, pound out a scene, and then we can talk about punching it up. But the idea of composing at a keyboard in a room, it's just crazy. I mean, ever so slightly back in the Seinfeld days, when Larry left the show, my first year was his last year. When Larry left the show, most of the time, it was still the concept of a writer. You know, every writer at Seinfeld was pitching out their four stories. You know, you needed a Jerry, a Kramer, a Lane. You know, you needed one for each. You know, in a good world, you had a story that had two of them in it, gave you a little more wiggle room. but the writer was responsible for his own episode. And after Larry left, we did institute sort of a little mini, I guess, rewrite room, I guess, of taking that script, and the writer, Jerry, and one or two of us would go through it for mostly punch-up and clarification. But again, trying to take the script, not trying to compose the script in the room.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like that's what Larry and Jerry were doing behind closed doors.
Absolutely. Pre-me.
So sort of bringing in other people to fill in for Larry.
Right. It took sort of like three of us to basically fill in for Larry, which is kind of
Was Seinfeld your first gig?
No, my, well, I guess technically my first gig, oddly enough, was, I'll preface all this with, I was Harvard Lampoon. So my first, I guess, TV credit.
I assumed when I saw a Simpsons credit.
There you go, yeah. my first TV credit was actually, believe it or not, when I was still in college. It was between my junior and senior year. The Lampoon did this Comedy Central special called MTV Give Me Back My Life. And it was a fake 10th anniversary documentary celebrating MTV's sort of origins. And it was sort of a, there's some funny things in it. It's terribly made and terribly done, but it was an incredible first experience. Sure. Just learning on the job. And one of the things,
who was behind that?
It was all Comedy Central. They kind of engaged the Lampoon to do this idea, and the idea, of course, was that because at the Comedy Central was half owned by Viacom, that MTV would help us out. Of course, they barely did, and we were promised all of these, you know, music personas, and of course, we had none of them. So it's an MTV documentary with a lot of people pretending to be music. I mean, it's
really funny.
Like I learned more about how badly it was made. In a weird way, about how to make things the right way.
Sure.
So in a kind of, it was a really wonderful learning experience. And then at the time, let's see, I'm trying to remember everything. The exec producer was a guy named Billy Kimball, who I now have working on Veep, who has worked with Al Franken for a gazillion years. And Al was serving as a consultant at Comedy Central. So he was sort of helping us a little bit on it, and then also played a little role kind of doing a version of his sort of Pat Robertson character, a preacher who hated MTV kind of a thing. So that was, I guess, my first gig. And then, like I said, that was between my junior and senior year. And then the following year, Al and Billy produced and Al hosted comedy coverage of the Democratic and Republican conventions. And that was called, what the heck was that called? It was Indecision 92. So that's where they used that name for the first time.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, for each convention, four nights of whatever, and we had to really fill it with a lot of material because it was, you know, the convention's like watching kind of like a telethon. And I got to write a lot with Al, which was really wonderful. And at the end of the summer, Al said to me on, you know, one of the good days, just said, you know, I want to talk to Lauren and Jim Downey about you. And I started at Saturday Night Live that August.
That's
wild. Yeah.
Were you, before this MTV thing, were you on course to write television? Is that what you were
interested in? I'm not sure I had told my parents that yet. And it certainly helped basically telling them, I'm blowing off all this other crap, but good news, I have a job at Comedy Central starting on Monday, and then one day before even that was done, good news, I'm starting at Saturday Night Live. That always helps. You know, I always wondered, you know, what med school I would be in had I not had that lined up. But I guess it was one of those things where I think I went to college as sort of a big sort of comedy nerd and TV movie guy of thinking, well, maybe somehow I could be an entertainment lawyer. That's somehow what I thought was
that
like
was
the be all
dream.
End all. Yeah. Because honestly, even though I sort of, you know, was like, I was pretty nerdy about stuff and into stand up albums and reading about things, it just didn't seem I knew that there were writers, but I'm not sure I was quite aware of like how one became a writer. Mm-hmm. And when I got to Harvard and kind of got into the whole Lampoon thing, and I don't even mean got into the Lampoon, I mean was into the idea of trying to get into the Lampoon, and sort of started to kind of learn about, these are people like me the people like me have been writing things like Saturday Night Live and whatnot, and at the time, you know, Letterman and Spy Magazine and all the things, and then The Simpsons started airing, and it was like, oh my God, those are, you know, so all of a sudden it seemed very doable. So I kind of went from the big dream of entertainment law to I might, you know, hopefully I can do this. So yeah, I mean, my eggs were in that basket. I mean, it would have been, I don't know quite what I would be doing, you know, otherwise.
Sure. And
so,
how was, writing with Al Franken? How does he work?
It was crazy early on because, you're just intimidated. I remember early when I first met him on the other project, mm-hmm. the MTV thing, he was... I think his deal at Comedy Central was something along the lines of they had kind of given him like an office, and I can't remember if he had an assistant or not that first year, but he was really sitting in his office there writing what I believe became the Stuart Smalley book. The Stuart Smalley character had taken off, and he sort of was writing this book, and it's a really neat book if anyone ever checks it out, because it is sort of... It is, in its own way, an actual self-help book, even though it's a parody of self-help books. So it's just kind of interesting. Anyway, so he was working on that book, and I remember something or other. I made a joke to him about he was writing something about going to visit his parents or something, and I made a joke about like something like it was a version of like note to self, like next time I'm going to stay in a hotel. The idea of like not going to stay with them anymore or something. And I remember him laughing at it, and I think that it made it into the book. And I was like, whoa, that was crazy. Because again, the comedy nerd in me had read like the Hill and Weingart book, the backstage history of SNL. I owned like. I still have them, like, in a box in a storage unit, like, weird old, like, SNL compilations and videotapes of, like, old Buck Henry episodes. Amazing. I had the Big Green script book, if you know that book.
I don't know that.
In 1978 or 9, they published almost, like, a soft cover fake script book filled with like real scripts with handwritten annotations and pictures. It's an amazing book if you can ever find it. But a lot of also new stuff in there too, but also some great sketches. So I was an SNL diehard. So for me, it was like Al Franken. So that's what I remembered about sort of the first time I met him and then kind of starting to get to know him. And then when I was brought back for his thing, it was just... He was just so good about, hey, let's try something about this. And we just made each other laugh, which was sort of, fantastic. And, I mean, there were these things we wrote that, I love to this day. There were these ongoing, this idea of, like, you know, when there's a poll and someone, 64% said yes, 17% said no, and the other percent said they don't know. And we did this thing. It was a very Bob and Ray thing, and Al's the one who got me into Bob and Ray. You know, again, I was a comedy nerd, but, you know, like,
of
my time. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And we did this thing. It was all about how, well, who are these don't knows and why don't they know? So then it was always these very complicated things about when we asked the people who don't know if they would like to vote for so-and-so, we asked them, why don't you know? And then there would be this and don't know, and it folded in on itself just wonderfully. And it was just writing these things, and there were these moments where you kind of step out of your body and just go like, oh, fuck me, I'm writing with Al Franken. and it is that kind of, why are you friends with anybody? We were simpatico. Sure. Comedy wise we made each other's laugh, kind of started to get to know his wife, his kids, I'm having dinner there, and it becomes a thing without you ever really quite realizing how or why. And like I said, at the end of the summer, he said, I want you to meet Jim Downey. And I met Jim. And the next thing I knew, I was hired.
That's
crazy. Yeah.
Did you have to, you met these guys. Did you have to submit material, or was it enough
that
you had done this other
I did not submit anything. I mean, basically, Al headhunted me, for lack of a better word. And, he... I don't want to put words in his mouth. I don't believe he had not done that much. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So how long were you at SNL?
I was there 3 years, which at the time, funny enough, at the time, that was a nice run. Nowadays, people stay like long times. I was actually just back. I went with Julia when she hosted, which was really fun. I did a week of, I am a credited writer that week.
And I
did the hours and whatever, and it's exactly the same. It's a lot more civilized, I will say, than when I was there. When I was there, it was a little crazier.
So what were the years? Who was the cast?
First year was 92-93. Okay. My first season was the height of Dana, Phil, all those guys. And so guys like Sandler and those guys were like featured players or maybe had just become cast members. And that was the election year. And that's when we did the big debate sketch where Dana was playing Perot and Bush and Phil was playing Clinton.
That was a huge year.
Yeah, the first, one of the best things, one of the best sketches I ever wrote, or I should say co-wrote with Al, that we did together was Clinton jogging into the McDonald's. Worlds after he won. That was a biggie for me and just sort of my sort of time there kind of a thing. And that sense of like, oh my God, they're playing this on like Sunday morning news shows. And they're like, this is in compilations. And I mean, it was really fun and really cool. And also a nice assist on that from Jim Downey as well. And it was just wild. So that was the start of it. And then Dana left and then Phil left and whatever. And my third year there was a tough year. It was that giant 17-person cast and Janine Garofalo and Chris Elliott and Mark McKinney and Michael McKean and, you know, good people who I am friendly with till this day, but it was not a good season of the show. And
why do you think that was?
When Dana and Phil and those guys left, I'm gonna say something that I think Jim Downey used to say. I think guys like Adam Sandler's hilarious. All those guys were really funny. But sometimes they were a little bit of specialty acts, meaning you didn't necessarily want to put Adam, and I don't mean this in a bad way, he wasn't going to be in a political sketch.
Sure.
We did a sketch, actually, I think at the beginning of that third season, which would have been the 94-95 season, called Clinton Auditions. It was about the fact that Phil had left and we didn't have anybody to play Clinton. And it was sort of like seeing fake versions of Adams Clinton and Spade's sort of Hollywood Minute Clinton and Farley's Fall Down. It was a parody of a parody, but there was a truth to the sketch, which was we're kind of fucked here in terms of like, I remember we did a, just to date it all, that would have been like Newt Gingrich Contract with America, and Farley became our Newt Gingrich, and we did a big Contract with America with different, congressmen and stuff, and we could barely fill the... I mean, we had a giant cast and yet couldn't do a lot of politics.
Well, it feels like a sketch show wants those multi-talented players, like a Phil Hartman.
Yes.
The ultimate.
We had a lot of... Jim Downey sort of used to say we had a lot of, like, special teams.
Sure.
We had a lot of kickers, but not a lot of, like running backs and quarterbacks.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
It was time. And oddly enough, the show completely retooled the following year, and the larger answer may have been it should have retooled that year.
Right.
But, one of the things about Lorne Michaels and, again, man hired me for, my first big job and has welcomed me back many, many times. My guess is he was being loyal a little bit to, his guys, and it took him a while to figure out that it needed to be retooled. And so, unfortunately, there was this year that kind of exists that there are moments, but it needed to be retooled.
Well, and then they
did do it. And, I don't have a great answer. Perhaps had it been retooled, who knows? I mean, would I have stayed? It's hard to answer that question. I was sort of slowly moving into aspects of like getting to be in charge of things and stuff, not the whole show. I mean, just like production role on some specials and things like that. And boy, it would have been fun to be like writing at Saturday Night Live with like Will Ferrell and those guys. 'Cause that was sort of the next gen, if you will. And a lot of my friends who kind of went to work the following year or the year after ended up staying a much longer time.
Oh, interesting.
But I do think
so
it sort of righted itself, but I think it did become a sort of a happier place.
That's really interesting. We always hear about how competitive the writing situation is there. Was that your experience?
I mean, it is and it isn't. I mean, I remember my first, I was on a 13-week contract. And, it was a nail-biting 13 weeks until you sort of hear that you're picked up and you're doing everything you can. If I didn't get a sketch on, I was, trying to write, commercial parodies. Those were some of the earliest things that I got on were commercial parodies. I was thrilled to get those on.
Do you remember some of the ones you had?
I don't remember the exact order of everything, but some of my favorite stuff I did a commercial parody called That's Not Yogurt, if you remember that. It's like, well, seriously, what is it? Well, we can't tell you, but it's not yogurt. At the end of that season, I think I had Nerf crotch bat, which was just a Nerf bat to hit people in the crotch with, and a board game called Oomph. And the basic thing was it was sort of a Trivial Pursuit game. You never saw the question. It just sort of started. You see someone, it'd be like, roll the dice. You'd see someone move. They'd take a card. And then if we're playing, you're the answerer, and we're partners. And I would take the card, and I would just go, And then you would be like, John F. Kennedy. I'd go, and it was just making really sounds until whatever. And, like, and it'd be like, I give up. And it'd be like, you know, chocolate, you know, just right. Which I enjoyed. So those were fun. And if I couldn't get that on, then I'm going to write update jokes till I can get something on. But no
there,
one
we should say, let me just interrupt for a second, that 13-week contract is not an unusual thing.
Very standard, but I mean, show, but incredibly standard, but nerve-wracking nonetheless.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, but it's self-imposed pressure, but I think it's somewhat easier to be a new writer there than any kind of new featured player or new cast member, where it's more palpable that you're not on screen or that you're being kind of a shitty extra in stuff, and that you are really worrying that if the audience doesn't start to get to know who you are, you're going to be out of there.
Yeah.
Whereas I could have something on and then not have something on for 2 weeks, but know that, like, well, it got some good laughs. And again, I'm sure I was more nervous when I think back on it, but I didn't necessarily as a writer feel like the sword of Damocles hanging over my head in that same way.
Was there a lot of independent study? Is that how it's done? You're pitching sketches
and then
going out
you're sort of pitching. You're making up stuff as a big Monday meeting, and a lot of those are fake pitches. And then you're kind of going off and finding stuff. And that's one of the things when I say that the show is a lot more civilized now. At least the week I was there, it just felt really a lot more organized in terms of, like, people are working on this, and this would be a good thing for the person, or maybe don't do that or work on that. And I will sort of say, when I was there, you know, Jim Downey was the sort of, I guess, you know, producer and also de facto head writer. And, you know, I guess as a, you know, a fair criticism, you know, not the most organized guy on the planet Earth, but allow me to preface that with, arguably, and, you know, again, it's a name that I think people know in comedy circles, but maybe the world doesn't know. But, and I say this having worked with just some really great, really funny people, and it's no, it's nothing against them in any way, shape, or form. Probably, though, Jim Downey, funniest human being on Earth. I cannot explain.
I've heard this before.
I cannot explain. I mean, I told a story, and forgive me, I don't mean to tell my same stories, but I told this story in the last Saturday Night Live book, the one the Washington Post, Tom Shale's book,
the oral history.
Yes, the oral history.
Yeah.
Which I sort of feel like when they were first interviewing us for it, it was not an oral history, and I sort of wish it hadn't been. I'm not a big fan of oral history. Well, I just feel like in oral histories, at some point, you do want somebody to go, "That's not what happened." And it kind of, for me, was an oral history that rehashed a lot of the same first 5 year stuff, which I know people care about, and kind of gave short shrift to times when I was there where the show perhaps was not as interesting a show to watch, but was no perhaps less interesting backstage. Anyway, you know, again, they make a book to sell it.
This is a new book to be written.
I guess
we
so.
Now have
right. Yeah, there you go. That no one really wants. But anyway,
come on.
So I told this in that book, and it's true, which is I can't explain it, but like, Jim wrote sketches like he was dictating them from sketches that were already written in his head. And I can't explain it other than that way. And, you know, so much of what you thought was funny, not you, but the world thinks it was funny on Saturday Night Live, was him. I mean, it just was. Just so much stuff. And he's incredible. I mean, sounds silly, but, you know, if the three great influences on me have been, and I'm thrilled, but I was very lucky to be Al Franken, Jim Downey, and then Larry David. I mean, you know,
that's an amazing sort of,
I'm a better writer for it. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. You know, I'm a better writer for being around those three guys than just I will ever be able to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think is the commonality among those three guys? Why do you think, you know,
I don't know, because
they're
so different.
They are.
I mean, they are so different in just so many different ways. It's incredible how different they are. Boy, that's an interesting question.
I mean, they responded to something.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, you know, even though they are very different, I've sort of found common ground with both of them. And I don't think they thought I was funny because they simply liked me. I mean, I think they genuinely, I hope they genuinely found me funny, or else they...
Well, you found the same things funny.
We found the same things funny, and we were able to sort of that moment in that happens in great kind of comedy writing where you can kind of put things together and add on top of what the other guy's doing. And, you know, they're different, you know, like Al's a much bigger laugher, you know, like when you're working with Al, you laugh a lot. And, you know, with Jim, you're always almost like not worried. It's not like oh my God, what's he thinking? But you know, it's sort of like it's almost like a more reasoned kind of like that's good. You know, like that's great. Or like you know, or if he does laugh, it's like oh, a downy laugh. Wow.
it's funny that like it sounds like he already knows the answer.
Probably like, yes. So that's what I was thinking too. Yeah. and with Larry. Somewhere in between, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a great answer. We just definitely, with all three of those guys, just something that I was able to sort of find sort of that kind of common ground of things that made us laugh.
That's in a really good way. Yeah.
FreshBooks is dead simple cloud accounting software that's saving millions of freelancers from the scourge of dealing with their day-to-day admin and paperwork. Yeah. I said scourge. It's the perfect word to describe agonizing tasks like formatting and tracking invoices, managing cash flow, dealing with expense reports, chasing late payments, other things. Nobody likes to do this stuff, except maybe the 5 million freelancers and small business owners already using FreshBooks. Invoicing. It literally takes about 30 seconds to create and send a really professional-looking invoice. Your clients can pay you online, which you can seriously improve how quickly you get paid. Late payment reminders. If a client forgets to pay you on time, FreshBooks will handle the awkwardness with customizable late payment reminders. Need more? Expense. FreshBooks has also cracked the code on expense tracking. You can set up FreshBooks to import expenses directly from your bank accounts, so next time you use your debit card for that business lunch, the transactions magically appear in your FreshBooks account. It's not actual magic. For a 30-day free trial, just go to freshbooks.com/writers and enter Nerdist Writers Panel in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Once again, 30-day free trial, go to freshbooks.com/writers, enter Nerdist Writers Panel in the How Did You Hear About Us section, and get yourself some FreshBooks.
Before we move away from Saturday Night Live altogether, were in your time there, were there... players or hosts that were particularly fun to write for or particularly challenging?
Oh, yeah, definitely so. I mean, the obvious answer now, but wasn't an obvious answer then, but, like, you know, Alec Baldwin used to come in every year, and if you knew it, he was on the books for, like, February, you'd save a good idea for
That's
him.
Hilarious.
You definitely would.
Do you remember writing something for him specifically?
I mean, the stuff I remember writing for him was, I think we wrote it for someone else and then saved it for him. And it actually, I think, didn't make air. I think the censors were bothered by it. But there was that period of those movies, like, not so much Fatal Attraction. It was more like Basic Instinct. It was that period of, like, the Basic Instinct movies. And forgetting about the scene of her not wearing underwear, but there was that kind of, like, it was always these, like, Michael Douglas having, like, rough sex with a woman where they're, like, kissing. And then the next thing you know, it's like he turns her around and kind of pushes her either into a wall and somehow, even though, the angles don't exactly make sense, they're having sex or pushes her down and whatever. And we sort of did a movie parody of that it was like, I think we had the idea originally, it was like, we got to save this for Alec Baldwin. I think it was Al and I wrote it, and it was like, we got to save it for him. And it was exactly what you think it was. It was just, he just kept turning people around and doing it, and, you know, it made its way to him doing it, I think, to Phil or what. I don't know, Phil may have been gone. No, Phil, I think, was still there. But it was what you thought. It was sort of the extrapolation thereof, but it was just sort of like, he can do this.
Right.
It, you know, just was, you know, you knew that was going to be fun.
That's funny.
You know, there were guys that you'd get excited about. I mean, I remember when Totoro hosts and just being so thrilled about having Totoro. Just guys that you wanted to be funny and then they, like, lived up to it.
That's great.
And then, yeah, you know, the athletes were a challenge. Sometimes they were a fun challenge, but a challenge nonetheless. Just, you know, they're not actors, and that was a hard week. And there were, and then some of the really serious people were just always a challenge.
Who were the serious people?
I don't know, like Jason Patrick in there, believe it or not, and hosted. And
like actors who you assume probably have a sense of humor.
Shaverberg and I, we have a sort of, comedy theory. It's not that brilliant an idea, but I'll say it anyway, which is, obviously, you know, if I say to you, like, oh, that guy, he's a really funny guy, whatever. But when you get past, like, the funny guys, I feel like we sort of have always felt like people fall into two categories. There's friends of comedy and, therefore, enemies of comedy. So that when you're talking about, like, you know, we got to cast somebody, well, you want to get a friend of comedy. They don't have to be a comedy generator, but you want a friend of comedy. And there
Like that's what Alec Baldwin is.
Yeah, I know. Alec, I think, has, I mean, maybe he started as a friend of comedy, but I think he has actually moved into generator of comedy. But... but you know, like, and again, I apologize, Jason Patrick. I'm a huge Lost Boys fan. No, I'm sure he does. A terrible show, and not a guy that should be doing comedy. I don't know what else to say. By the way, though, Joe Pesci, not necessarily a chummy, funny, like pally around kind of guy, but understood what he was and what he could do to make for a very funny show. And obviously you can see it, like, in Goodfellas, why he can be funny, even though he's not funny.
Right.
I guess is the answer. Yeah.
He knows the tools that he has.
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
Then you guys can figure out
how to use. And there were hosts that you came in and you kind of kept at arm's length. And then there were hosts that came in that you did get to pal around with, which was wonderful.
That's
really
fun.
So that was fun, too. And then there were horrible hosts, too. I will say this. And again, I don't know what was going on in her life, but... the week Roseanne hosted, I remember her coming in, and, you know, this was all her and Tom Arnold and whatever. It was just her hosting, though. I remember her, I feel like early in the week, she just looked at me and went, I don't like you. And I just went, okay, and I just kind of hid out upstairs because it's like, all right, I don't need this, you know?
No, and it's better for her that you weren't
around. It was a terrible
show.
That's showing.
Yeah. when you get someone who, you know, whether it's a sports figure or whatever, when you guys find out this is the host, is there something you can do to dummy-proof that comedy?
I mean, you try. You know, you try and take advantage of them. You know, at the time, I remember, you know, this was in the middle of the great, all the Nancy Kerrigan stuff and whatnot. And, you know, she was game, not necessarily a great actress, not necessarily perhaps a friend of comedy. But, you know, we did there was a very funny, you know, ice skate. You know, that show had a lot of scrutiny at the time because of what was going on. I actually think there are pieces in that show that hold up sort of better than they were perhaps at the time. But, you know, there's a really funny ice skating sketch where Farley is her sort of... or her partner, her figure partner who has gotten out of shape, and therefore they can't quite do what they're supposed to be doing, and she's kind of getting angry, but it's sort of, you know, it lets Farley be funny on ice, and then she's there. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And,
oh, absolutely.
You know, and that's what you kind of look for.
Yeah.
So
you can lean on that.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Worked a little harder on
And there are guys, you know, like a guy like Charles Barkley, he's not a precise comedian, but obviously as his sort of post like TNT career has shown, he can be a funny guy. You know, we did silly things that, you know, I remember a sketch that I loved, which was, it was Charles Barkley's Big, Tall, and Black Men's Store. And it was like, this size 7XL, yellow, canary yellow, you know, suit. And it was a lot of that kind of stuff. And he was game for it. And you tried to, like, get other people in it. And, you know, you try and take the, you know, that they don't have to, how do I, the sports terminology, they don't have to carry the ball quite as much in a perfect world.
Sure. Makes sense. So at what point...
Nowadays, by the way, I think they probably would do... They do a lot more film pieces nowadays, and those film pieces definitely take the pressure off because you can edit and whatever.
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, even I know we started this discussion with talking about like commercial parodies being the stuff that I first got on. I mean, all through my 3 years there, I enjoyed a lot of the sketch stuff I did, but I mean, I still am probably really proud of a bunch of the like commercial parodies and stuff that I got to do sort of later on, just because they are sort of complete pieces that are the way you want them to be unto themselves, which. In Sketchland, you know, live Sketchland,
very limited,
hit and miss. Yeah.
So, at what point did you start to write narrative scripts that were not just sketches?
The third year I was there, I definitely started going, this is not fun. I will also tell you, you know, everyone knows about the sort of the after party, if you will. And the after party started to seem to me, and I don't know, not that I've had a lot of like self-reflection, but I definitely sort of started to feel like, boy, I'm just going to those after parties and trying to drink as much wine as humanly possible. And I would end my evenings home at like 4 or 5 in the morning or whatever it was, and I always taped the show. And I would always, before I went to bed, I would always watch the tape of the episode because being at SNL and being in that studio, there's, you know, it's like I don't know if people know, like, Rao's in New York, where it has, you know, the secret Italian restaurant that has like seven tables. It's like you're really excited to be there and whatever. And
it's a different experience.
And we'd go to the party, and I'd be going, this was not a good show, but people were in a happy mood. And I'd go home at, like, you know, 5 a.m. and watch the tape and go, that was a shitty show. And they were getting a little bit worse. They were getting very repetitive. There was a lot of, you know, and I was as responsible as the next guy, because I was definitely a guy that, like, what, there's no monologue? All right, I'll try another one this week. And we were doing a lot of question and answer monologues. We were doing a lot of sketches of, like, Farley yelling. I mean, there was a lot of just stuff that just got very similar.
That you know,
well, yeah, you were sort of leaning.
Home.
Yes, exactly. And it was just, I wasn't enjoying the show. Yeah. I know that. And, I know, like I said, I could see it was whatever. So I was definitely unhappy, and I was starting to think about leaving. Schaefer and Berg, who I had known since college, and we always, you know, even when we weren't writing together, we were always, like, you know, looking at each other's things, you know, the early days of email, but also, dare I say, faxing and whatnot, if anyone can remember what that is. And so they were actually in New York during the back end of my first year. They got a job at Conan. So they were in New York. So they were working downstairs at Conan, who had just gotten the show, which Lorne was producing. And so that was kind of going on. And then they went back to L.A., and they were all but ready to move back full time, I think, when they got the Seinfeld job. So my second year of SNL, that was their first year of... Is that right? No, that's not right. They got the job. Sorry, I'm a year early. My third year of SNL, they got the...
That makes more sense.
Yes, yes. So they got the... My third year was their first year of Seinfeld. And as I was...
And it was how deep into Seinfeld was it? Fourth
year? That would have been the fifth season, I believe. Because I think I was there 6, 7, 8. Does that sound right? No. It must have been the sixth season. Because we're 9 seasons of Seinfeld?
Who knows? 15, I want to say. Is it still on?
23, like it's on. Bonanza?
Bonanza.
Little Joe had
so, but it would have been on for a few years.
Yes,
when
got there. When they got there, it was it had become the hit already, so they were there, and I was trying to leave town because if I was sticking, we would work like 2 shows and have a week off. So I started going out to LA to visit, just to get out of New York, so that I wasn't just going to the office and sitting there and staring, because that's what we kind of did. It was a real, I don't know, like hostage mentality. So I was going out there, and so I started hanging out at the Seinfeld offices. And, you know, at that point, though, and Larry, I think, was also renegotiating, so he wasn't even sure that he was coming back. So I wasn't necessarily whatever, but I started to kind of go, I was in L.A., I started taking meetings, basically, for lack of a better word, because I was unhappy, and I knew I was unhappy. And right at the end of my season, right at the end of that third season, which I think was the Heather Locklear show, Larry came through New York on his way to Europe and had re-signed and was going back and whatever, and said, I want you to submit some material. But I got the sense he had definitely talked to Jim Downey about me, because they had known each other from when they had worked together.
Yeah.
And then a couple of weeks later, got a call from Larry basically going, you know what, forget it, don't submit anything.
What would you have submitted?
Well, it was funny enough, I don't know. Larry never cared about spec scripts. He wanted idea lists. But later on, when I was pitching out some of my shows, I remember him going, this would have been my first show, which was The Pool Guy, which I believe the story was the Kramer becomes the movie phone guy, if you can remember that.
Yep.
That was a real thing that had happened, not exactly that way, as are the great Seinfeld ideas, I think, which is you sort of take half a piece of something and turn it into something. And I remember pitching him that idea and him really liking it and kind of saying something to me like, would that have been on your list? Was that on your list? Because I was keeping a list, and I went, yeah. And he goes, I would have hired you. So that was good. So that was good, at least.
He felt he made the right choice.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So just kind of moved over to that.
Right.
Yeah, but I was definitely, and I apologize again. I think Paul Sims was half led to believe that I was definitely going to news radio, which I would have loved.
Sure.
But I mean, you know, at the, you know, Seinfeld for me at that moment was just, And like I said, I had been spending a lot of time out there and had kind of gotten to know not so much the cast, but definitely had gotten to know Larry and Jerry a bit, but also, but the staff.
Right.
And I, it was a really nice fit. So, I mean, that was very exciting for me, not just the show, but those people, which
that's,
was kind of cool.
That's really exciting. And we've talked to a couple of Seinfeld writers from over the years there, and it was, again, all of this independent study that you guys would just go and pitch storylines, right?
But you were pitching your stories out, and you were then working on your outline. And, I learned a lot of the building blocks of what I'm still doing, which is it's all about the story. If the one-sentence story nugget isn't, like, something unto itself that's worth expounding on, then you've got nothing to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember going off and outlining my first show, and I put up, you know, Act One on my dry erase board, and Larry and Jerry came in and crunched it down to two scenes.
Wow.
And then I did more of Act One, and they crunched it. And, you know, and again, this is my first one.
Right.
But
That's so valuable.
When you think about that, what you're learning is, first of all, what it did was, is basically it was saying where another show might be in the middle, and you can extrapolate this. So what all that crunching did, though, when you think about it is, think about where another show, where I went in there thinking my show at the midpoint and where at the end is. By the time they're done with me, in some ways, that... At best, what I thought the end was is maybe the act break, which if you think about it, what you basically are saying is that sort of Seinfeld's kind of got going where other shows ended.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that speed. It was that density. It was all of these things. But also, like, what was so unique about the storytelling was it kept going beyond. I mean, first of all, it was telling better stories than the traditional sitcom, but it was then going way beyond where they ever went. And obviously, as the show became more successful, they got more and more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just think about the crunching down, what, you know, so when you watch, you know, when I watch, especially at the time, I can remember watching sitcoms, and you know, I always like to pick on the Jim Belushi show as the perfect example of a sitcom starring the brother of a guy that we thought was funny. You know, they would... Jim, take the garbage out. And then they would talk about that for, 15 minutes. And at the end of the act, he didn't take the garbage out. And then act two, you still didn't take the garbage out. And then at the very end of the show, all right, I'll take the garbage out. Again, obviously, we would never do something like that. But in some ways, we're going to take that garbage out in scene two. So now what? I mean, just it's a way of thinking about it. And I think it's a way of thinking about it where if you actually I think it changed a lot of comedy in general. I think Seinfeld is the great sort of that was where so much of what everything is now comes from.
I think you're right.
And I think Larry then did it again later on with Curb, too. But Larry and Jerry with Seinfeld, I think that's where you see most of the good comedy coming from. Because even something like Veep, I think you can draw a direct line, not because Julia's in both, but just the speed, the density, the where you're going with it, the sort of,
the
not that it's
turns.
About nothing, but that it is sort of, it's minutiae, but under a magnification and all this kind of stuff. So it all goes back to that, but that's kind of, that's where I... As much as anything, that's where I learned to write sort of, you know, whether it's a 2-act structure, which is what we were doing, or even a 3-act structure, where every scene has to move the story forward, and everything is story, story, story.
Have you been able to, you know, as you've gone on and run shows, and even, I'm sure you've sold pilots and things over the years, is that something you've been able to instill in your writing
I believe it's present in my writing, and I would actually believe, and I guess if I'm very proud of one thing, I do think I want to just say this as clearly as possible, just because again I am a fan, I was a fan of the show, but there are differences, and neither is better or worse. I just want to, because you just don't want these things sort
of course,
you know, whatever, parceled out. But I do think when you watch Veep, our season, I think there is a little more of an adherence to what I'm talking about in terms of there is more story and there is more forward movement in the average scene/episode that I'm always trying to keep plots moving forward in scenes. Scenes don't exist unless plot is moving forward. And that's just, like I said, that's how I was taught to write by these guys.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm doing. And I have definitely tried to do it, you know, on shows. Obviously, the Clerks cartoon would not have been so successful had I not been doing that. But, you know, no, exactly. But, you know, by the way, though, when I have tried to do network stuff, you know, sometimes it's almost like an issue. You know, it's like, you know, not, I don't want to say too much plot, but
Right. You know, well, it's not
what they're
used
to.
Anymore.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, there was a period of maybe 10, 15 years where it was the fallout of Seinfeld, but it's kind of...
But to me, you can do that with anything. You can do it with a family show or whatever. It's not. It's just about storytelling where scenes exist for a reason. Whereas, again... And again, I'm not judging good or bad. I have my own opinions. Mm-hmm. But they did a thing. Someone showed it to me online. I had nothing to do with it. It was fascinating to me. But I think they took an episode of Seinfeld. They took an episode of, I want to say, The Big Bang Theory and maybe Friends. Mm-hmm. And they, quote unquote, removed the jokes. Okay? And when they removed the jokes, The Big Bang Theory was like a minute long. Like, the actual plot was a minute long. And Friends was somewhere in the middle. Seinfeld, though, was actually still like, you know... I don't know, like 9 or 10 minutes long because their plot was always advancing with great jokes. Yeah. But I will tell you, and by the way, this is how I learned to edit as well. You can sacrifice a good joke if you have to make sure the plot keeps moving. And you will cut things that are really, really funny to keep things moving.
Of course.
And there are times where scenes can be too long. They can be really funny, but too long. And if you're not paying for it there, then you're going to pay for it at the end, where somehow it all seemed really funny, but why are people not loving it at the end? Well, that's because what should have been, you know, we do Veep right now, it's 28 minutes and 30 seconds, and, you know, sometimes we stray a little bit into 29, and there were definitely times where I sat down with, you know, like a 48-minute cut and wondered, how the hell is this going to get, you know, I'm going to have to ask them for 35 minutes, and I cannot tell you how the difference between the 35-minute version and what ultimately became, let's say I couldn't get it perfect, but the 28, whatever, you know, it's night and day. It's just they're better shows with that discipline.
Have you been able to take that to the page? Are you a good self-editor?
No. I overshoot. Page counts are too long. And then I force it to work in the edit room. And so far it's working, but it's always a little scary.
Of course.
Yeah.
We've also heard of how tough the Seinfeld non-room could be in that... You're turning over story and you're turning over story. Well, I mean, and then you have to keep going back to pitch it, right? Until something is accepted.
Yes, you would, you know, and it was, you know, I can remember like getting one or two and then struggling for like whatever. And, you know, and it was nerve wracking again, especially because my first year, though, I had a full year contract, but there was a writer that didn't have a full year contract that was gotten rid of, you know, after his minimum. And he was a new writer. And I think in retrospect, you know, perhaps didn't necessarily, it wasn't the greatest fit, but has gone on to wonderful things, so we won't even worry about it. But the larger point is, so it wasn't like I was worried, but obviously the desire not to fail. But yeah, to come up with the stories was not easy. Yeah. And as I progressed, and again, you know, it's that thing of what I thought was a story, and then once I worked there, what I realized was a story.
Sure.
You do get better at then, therefore, also having stories.
But the target becomes much
clearer. But earlier on, it was sort of like, oh, is this a story? And but by the way, and this is just a problem in, I guess, comedy writing in general, and I was talking about this the other day with Alec Berg of Silicon Valley, where when you're working with writers who, and again, this is not an attack on anyone, but when they don't necessarily get the story thing and the plot thing, you get pitched, in lieu of story, you get pitched like funny lines, you get pitched funny locations, you get pitched funny a lot of locations. Things that are funny or interesting, but you know what I mean, but are not stories.
You're pitched a set piece. But
yes,
not a
exactly. Yeah.
That's interesting. Can you look at an episode from your time there that you feel like was either hard fought or, you know, you're particularly proud of?
I mean, that my first episode was The Pool Guy, and I'm thrilled with it. But I will also tell you, like, a lot of the great things in it are Larry Jerry lines. Mm-hmm. That's what Seinfeld was then.
Yeah.
I was thrilled that they liked it. I believe that one went to the table. My draft went to the table, which at the time was like, oh my God, my first draft went to the table. But you know, there's a lot of the great, like, a lot of the great memorable lines in terms of like, You know, like George's relationship, you know, with Susan and not wanting her to be friendly with Elaine, which was my story and a story that I'm so proud of and was a great, you know, a good story in there. But a lot of the lines about like independent George and a George divided can't stand against himself. That's them. And I will stand there, you know, and tell you. And I think I won a Writers Guild Award and they wrote those lines. You know what I mean? But the plot is mine.
Was that thing of, I mean, being written is absolutely part of
Of course.
Was that easy for you to accept?
Yes, because it was so good. I mean, it only made it better. You know what I mean? Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. But, you know, I guess what was great, though, was things like, you know, a lot of the movie phone stuff was very much of mine. And why don't you just tell me the movie, you know, like, and even some of the movie names. So, you know, I mean, I'm in there. I want to be clear. I've got a lot in there too. And again, it is about story and those things. A lot of, you know, I was thrilled with, you know, that was, you know, early on something that, again, I think has worked for me, which was sort of as a fan of the show and as somebody who was thinking a lot about the show, what was interesting about Elaine? Well, Elaine is always hanging out with these guys, but she has no female friends. When we've seen female friends of hers, they sort of seem awful. Like, you got to see the baby, whatever. Right. So it was this sort of analysis of she does not have female friends, and as most women who I've known in my life who don't have female friends, they don't like being told you don't have any female friends, and then tries to make a female friend with Susan. And so I'm thrilled with how that worked out, even though, again, I credit Larry and Jerry for, like, the independent George stuff. So, yeah. So that was my first one. Whereas, you know, I guess, you know, I've always joked, you know, they'll put on my gravestone the Bizarro Jerry. And ultimately, obviously, that is in the season without Larry. That was sort of the second, that was at the beginning of the second, of my second season, which was the first season without Larry. And I do think there are, you know, and again, I don't know where people are, what people think anymore. What I remember in terms of being there was we did a full season without Larry that people were really, really into. And then when we did our second season, where I definitely think we were, which was the, what became the final season of Seinfeld, I think we were bushed. We could have, I think there were some things that I think needed to happen that didn't happen. We could have used some new blood and things like that, and it didn't happen. And we had just gotten stretched too thin trying to sort of fill in for Larry and whatnot. And I think that's part of why Jerry ended it. Maybe there might have been another version of things where we could have kept going. I don't think it had to end, but it, that version of it had to end. But what I was, what I, where I was, anyway, what I, but I was going to say is, but then somehow when people didn't love that final season quite as much, and there were a couple of, like, has Seinfeld lost it? And obviously these reviews are reviews. Yeah. They like to write that they love it, so that then they can write they hated it. So then you can, when they like it again, they can go, oh, we, they listened to us, you know, and that's fine. That's all fine and good. But it was weird because when it sort of started to not be, and again, people still loved it, but you know what I'm saying? Like, oh, it's not quite whatever. Then all of a sudden it became, well, since Larry left, it's not as good. It was like, well, no, we did a year there that you everybody really liked. Anyway, the Bizarro Jerry was the beginning of that second season, and I am thrilled with every aspect of that. I mean, rarely am I happy with, you know, the way things are in something, and I was thrilled with, like, every aspect of that one. You know, in a way that probably not until, like, you know, some of these Veep episodes where I'm truly just happy with every aspect of it. Usually I am my own critic. And there, by the way, there are episodes. One of the most fun ones to write was I did the backwards episode with Peter Melman. It was called The Betrayal. And I really like that episode. I don't think the Kramer story is awful. It doesn't particularly work. So I'm the first to say that, which is different than, say, an episode like The Susie, which I think is a terrible episode that never quite clicked. I mean, I know every once in a while I, like, have a dream, believe it or not, where I still am trying to, like, figure out the Jerry story because it never quite worked. And it should have been funnier and it just wasn't. And to this day, it makes me fucking crazy. And it was also, I don't know, it just, but anyway, that's what writing is, I guess. But yeah, so there are episodes that I worked on that I think are not great.
Sure, of course.
That's what it is.
You write a certain number of episodes, there are going to be a few stinkers.
That was a hard one. But with the backwards one, boy, we had other pieces of that Kramer story that I think could have been something.
Interesting.
We had started originally with this concept that you would see, because again, it starts at the end and whatever. Right. I've been talking a lot about the backwards episode for whatever reason because, well, I can say it now because this won't be till later. Our ninth episode, our second to last episode of the season of Veep, is, if you were watching earlier in the season, Catherine has been making this movie. And what people right now don't know quite yet is when they tune the episode on Sunday, the entire episode is a documentary that she made.
I've been waiting for this.
Okay, good, 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 good. And basically no credits. No,
I thought it would be online, but I love that it's an episode.
Yeah, the entire episode is the documentary. Awesome. As if it were a documentary that HBO is airing. There's no Veep opening credits. It has movie credits at the end. It is the documentary.
Amazing.
So we have told nobody. Right now, nobody knows this. Actually, oddly enough, I think Matt Walsh hadn't been told this, and so he mentioned it in Entertainment Weekly, but clearly print is dead because no one has seen it or mentioned it. Yeah.
That's really funny.
But we did no promo for the show. The promo was just there's two to go.
Right.
There's no nothing. Nobody knows this is happening. Most people seem to think that the documentary is going to be a story element that somehow undoes her presidency, which we talked about, by the way.
Of course.
But the notion of the whole episode is the doc, I think hopefully when this is airing, people think it's quite good. But anyway, I've been
really
talking about the backwards episode a lot because when the backwards episode happened, I was driven a little cuckoo at the time. And again, I didn't have particularly much power, but NBC promoed the fuck out of it, doing the whole, it starts at the end and it begins at the beginning or whatever, or starts at the end and whatever. And in some ways, sold it like it was a classic episode. And my sort of feeling is you can never live up to being sold as a classic episode. And by the way, it was received very well. But I did always wonder, what if people had just turned on Thursday night and seen this backwards thing? And, and with no idea, much in the way they watched those who were watching the episode with them at the Chinese restaurant or them in the, you know, like, here's something where we're not telling you it's this special thing. It just is. Now, let's face facts. Had this small change, I don't think this is the stepping on the butterfly that makes, you know, Hitler and dinosaurs president. I just think we'd all be still sitting here, but I guess I'd be slightly happier. But anyway, so with this documentary, we've told no one.
That's,
you know,
really cool.
I'm going to murder you after this.
Of course.
But yeah,
that was the plan anyway.
Yes, exactly. But I've been talking about the backwards one a lot because of that whole thing. I was always a little angry at NBC for sort of giving it away. So anyway, I don't know. Somewhere in there was an answer to one of your questions.
That's really cool. That's really neat. It's been an hour already, I believe.
I'm okay going, but whatever.
I have some things I want to talk about.
Okay, go for it.
But you'll come back sometime.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. You've written a couple of features.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear what itch that scratches for you.
Well, there's probably just a very simple base one, which is I grew up going to the movies. My mom was a moviegoer, and she dragged me, you know, back when there were revival theaters, whether it was going to see, you know, Hitchcock festivals and whatnot, or just going to the movies. You know, that was my desire. Like, my childhood, my teenage years is just, what did my friends and I do? Every Friday night we went to the movies, and if we could go. And by the way, back when there used to be a lot of movies every week, and there'd be two or three movies, we'd go Friday night and Saturday night. That was independence to me. That was whatever. So there is that visceral sort of like, I am doing this, which I used to sit in the theater. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely that. I do think there is something to be said for telling sort of a standalone, you know, story that is complete unto itself. There's something wonderful about ongoing stories where characters can really grow and develop and you can change things and, you know, the way like working on a good sitcom can be. But there is something really nice about, here's a, whatever it is, hour and a half, here is a story beginning to end. There's just something very cool about that, like a peek into this sort of window of this world kind of a thing.
Sure, that makes sense.
You know, and obviously with television the way it is now, those lines have blurred because, you know, you can do almost anything you want on television. So you could probably just do, you know, clearly only Netflix and Amazon are only going to start making more and more movies, which will be good because right now, like, it seems like you can't make a comedy movie without three people and it has to cost $100 million because it has to, you know. It has to because it's going to cost them $150 million to market it, so they're not going to spend $150 million on a $20 million movie. But I do believe those they're going to start making more movies, and I think that's going to be good for comedy movies especially. Anyway,
absolutely.
So I guess that's some of the itch, I guess, if you will.
That makes sense. I mean, it's interesting, too, like, you know, coming from the kind of TV you started out doing and comparing it to Veep, which is, and even like Silicon Valley, which these are serialized shows.
Yes,
this is
absolutely
not what sitcoms used to be.
Right, no.
It is a different mode of storytelling.
No, definitely so. I mean, we have so much more. I mean, with those two shows, especially this season, you know, where like again, if you took out all the jokes, I think, you know, there's a very interesting story about the Absolutely. Election being resolved or what's going on with, you know, Hooli and whatever on Silicon Valley. Yeah. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. Have there been... Do you know, is there another season to Veep? Do you know that already?
Oh, yes. We've been renewed. Okay. Yeah, we were renewed, I think we were renewed right before it started, right when it started. Yeah, yeah. Great. So we're good to go. And by the way, when I sat down with Julia and then and HBO back, you know, over a year ago, again, I don't want to put words in their mouth. I think had they only been wanting to do one more season or resolve the election, I don't know. I feel like maybe they could have figured out a way to do it with Armando or something, or a special or one of those kind of things or something, and resolve it. But I think Julia definitely felt like there was life, and I think. I know HBO felt like there was life, and I don't think, and not in a cash grab kind of way, because that's not really, I mean, believe me, they spend quite a lot of money on this thing. I don't, you know, I think it's about that there was a sense of there's more to be had here. And so as I started thinking about the show, and again, I like to think about things, you know, a lot of what I was thinking was sort of, as I said, when I kind of came up with how I thought this season was going to end, it was as much about this then happens so that then we can do this. Mm-hmm. And so that was always my goal. And even as I'm thinking now about as that some of that's going to be what we're going to start working on soon for this next season, I'm already sort of half landed on where I think it ends, which then allows us to do this. Mm-hmm. So my sort of plan is there's at least a couple more years here, whether they want to do it or not. But I mean, I know from like, I can't speak for the whole cast, but I mean, it's a really special character Armando created, and Julia, the combo of what he created and what she brought to it. So let's say she ends it.
And it feels like that with every character too.
Yeah. And I agree. I completely agree. With Julia, it's like, you know, everyone always talks about the fact that she's done, you know, these, you know, she's won like whatever Emmys for these three or four, whatever. It's like, is she going to really do another sitcom after this? I don't know. Maybe she will. Maybe she will. I mean, God knows if anyone could.
No one expected this one.
Right. But why end it? I mean, look, I'll be the first to end it the second I feel like we don't have a story. We're not doing something interesting. We're not doing something original. But I think there's more there. I mean, I did from the get-go.
It certainly feels that way. And in fact, this season feels refreshed in a way. Even, I came in not knowing there was a new show, and I don't know a lot about the behind the scenes of that show. And it felt a different energy. It felt a renewed energy and really satisfying.
And I think it is different. And I will also say, and I've said this from the beginning, that I feel like if we were doing exactly what they were doing, it never quite would have been exact. And then you're in one of those sort of like looking at like a Louis Vuitton bag on the street going like, it really looks close, but there's something off about it. And that would have been the worst thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. No, you did a good job. You deserve the accolades. Everyone involved. It's a great season, and people can watch it on HBO Go, steal your parents' password. What are you watching on TV these days? What have you been excited about?
I was in a big TV hole for a while because I like to watch TV while I do stuff. I watch TV the way other people like listen to music. So I will, believe it or not, I'll even write to TV or
really,
movies. Yeah. With that stuff, it has to be a little more mindless, like or something I'm familiar with. Like I can put on like the two Godfather movies and write a Veep, you know what I mean? And there's sometimes somatic connections, but that's not the reason. There are weird movies that I get hooked on. Like I went through a period, a friend of mine, Brian Kelly, who I wrote The Simpsons with, I'm not sure he can ever watch the movie Volcano again because I made him watch it so many times when we were working on a pilot a million years ago. I was just obsessed. Not obsessed with the movie, but I just found it
was
very
great
easy.
Wallpaper.
And, yes, it's wonderful wallpaper, and it kind of releases my mind in some way.
Funny.
So I'll watch a lot of sitcoms and stuff like for those reasons. I categorize things different. There are sitcoms I enjoy. I think they're good and they make me laugh. But then there are ones I truly love. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Walk us through it. We got nowhere to go.
Yeah, I've been catching up. I caught up on a bunch of the HBO stuff. So I watched the Anita Hill thing, which was okay. I found it more fascinating, the stuff I didn't know, than it as itself as a movie. But I love the LBJ thing. I don't know if you watched
it. Oh, really?
I
haven't watched it.
Oh, the LBJ thing all the way
all
is
right.
So good. So good. Then I moved on to, I just watched all 10 episodes of the OJ, the People versus OJ.
Mm-hmm. The FX one.
The FX one, not the documentary.
The drama.
The dramatization, whatever.
Fantastic.
And I literally today I downloaded the Tubin book, and I downloaded Vincent Bugliosi, who was the district attorney who prosecuted mm-hmm. Manson. He wrote a book basically about, I guess, what a bad job the DAs did about God. It. And I sort of downloaded both of those. I'm going to read both of those because I loved it so much. And the cast was so good. But those guys, Larry,
Scott and Larry, yeah.
Oh my God, I met them years ago, and
they're great.
They have a real knack for that sort of real life.
Check
story
out the episode
thing.
Of this.
Oh, that's there, the one before me. Okay, great. Oh, okay. I will tell you, they are just God. It's so good. But then the casting was just amazing. Yeah, just amazing. So I just watched that. When I first finished, I caught up on the X-Files, mm-hmm. which, you know, I've become, you know, it's funny, there's an I Want to Believe poster hanging right there.
You're in the right place.
Yes, there were one or two that I really loved. I loved having them all back. You know, those mythology episodes just don't do much for me anymore. But
Did they at the time? Were you
early on? Early on. But it was sort of like, you know, somewhere in that sort of third or fourth season, it switched over to me for the standalones. When you reach that magical moment, and, you know, I had it certainly with Lost, where you just go, I'm not quite sure they really have an answer here. Sure. And then it's just like, oh, yay. And I was actually surprised that there was so much mythology after this much time. I wondered if six episodes, standalones, whatever. But my gosh, I was so happy to know that there was going to be a Darren Morgan episode, and it lived up to everything I wanted it to be. That was really enjoyable. We talked earlier, not on this, but before we sat down, I'm a comic book guy, but I finally got caught up on the two seasons of Daredevil, yeah, sure. which I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Slow in places, but I did really, really enjoy it, and really enjoyed Jessica Jones. Yeah. That was really, really good. I finally got caught up on, when the show ended, I got caught up on Master of None, which I hadn't mm-hmm. watched. Really good. And I also, not that obviously people are, you know, go from different shows. I was a huge Parks and Rec fan, and I missed that show. And obviously he's not the character, right. but I...
There's so much of Aziz in
Tom. Yes, yeah. exactly. So it was sort of, in a good way, a familiar face that I really, that's really cool. liked. I'm trying to think what else. And that's a lot of what I've been kind of watching
that's a lot
so
of great
far.
Songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. And you've scratched the surface, too. Like, that's the
no, there's
thing.
More. I mean, I have
what
always liked...
Now.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much television, obviously. But I like TV. I mean, I really do. I
it's
mean,
nice to
yeah.
hear.
No, I honestly, I mean, again, I, you know, we were like, you know, not, I don't want to say we were latchkey kids, but, you know, I grew up in New York and we'd come home from school and, you know, had keys and went in and waited mm-hmm. for our folks to get home and watched TV and, you know, watched, you know, shows that I'm not sure my children will ever watch, you know, like Brady Bunch and mm-hmm. stuff because they watch what they want to watch when they want to watch it.
Yeah.
I watched what was on. Now, I had some choices between the two local channels and maybe the ABC afternoon movie, but I did watch some of that. And I like to think I'm a better person for watching all of those shows. You know, there is something, you know, again, you know, you talk about like, well, why are you the writer you are, whatever. I don't know. Sometimes I think it's because Channel 11 in New York City had The Odd Couple and The Honeymooners on every night from 11 to midnight, and then if I didn't watch that, I could watch MASH, especially early MASH, yeah. early like Henry years MASH with Trapper John on Channel 5. So those were my choices, 5 or 11 if I was staying up late, and obviously early Letterman, whereas now often I'll, you know, TiVo, you know, sort of a talk show, but rarely right. do I watch a whole talk show. I'll watch online bits that people are sending around or that sort of bubble up. But,
yeah.
you know, but I used to watch Letterman, you know, every night, things like that, that, you know, I think
that's
are
so
all
formative.
Part of why yeah. I'm the writer I think I am or hope
absolutely.
I am. Yeah.
Really good. Well, this was great.
Oh, this
please
is fantastic.
Come back and talk
I would,
to
anytime,
us.
Honestly. Anytime. It was
a pleasure.
Really fun.
Congrats on Veep.
Thank you. Really fun.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.